from Social Security, the class of Social Security, and reimburse itself. This reimbursement is other legal process prohibited by federal law. The law is set out by the Supreme Court in Philpott and Bennett, this court in Tidwell, the Ninth Circuit in Crawford is clear. If the state is owed money by a recipient, even if the state is providing all of the care for the recipient, the state may not receive any of that money, Social Security money, unless there is this voluntary consent. The law is also clear that a protective payee is not an adjudication of incompetence. The federal regulations specifically state a payee can be appointed regardless of whether you are competent or not. And as I indicated, Indiana law is clear that commitment is not a declaration of incompetence. She specifically, Ms. Mason, the class, specifically have the right to dispose of their property still. Therefore, although the payee...
But among the property they don't have the right to dispose of is Social Security benefits. And that's what the representative payee declaration does. Let me tell you what my problem is. I can't see why paying for the care is any different from deciding that the recipient, say, would benefit from a sweater,
mm-hmm.
buying a sweater and paying for that. Would that also violate the statute?
No. The difference, of course, is that in paying for the care, when the payee is the state, the payee is acting as creditor. And as a creditor...
But I don't see why that's any different. Your argument seems to be that paying anything out of these benefits violates the anti-alienation clause, and that event you couldn't pay for a sweater either.
No, I think our argument is that the state reimbursing itself is the state acting as creditor. And there is nothing in the protective payee process, in the appointment process, in the notice received, that...
Suppose the state gets your client a driver's license,
mm-hmm.
right? The representative payee pays the $75 fee to renew the driver's license. Violation of the statute?
No.
But now I've made the state the supplier of services.
But again, the state in this case, in our case, is acting as a creditor.
Yes. State wants to charge $75 to renew the driver's license.
Oh, I'm sorry. Because the state, of course, is the person who gets the money. Exactly. No, because here, what the state is doing, it is reimbursing itself for the bill.
So why is the driver's license any different?
Well, for one thing, according to Tidwell, Tidwell comes into play when the state is requiring or taking a pool of money for services that would otherwise be free. The driver's license would not otherwise be free.
In what sense is this service free? As you've described
mm-hmm.
it sounds like litigating informal corporis in court. The money is charged and accrued.
That's correct.
But if for some reason it can't be paid, the state won't withhold the service. But somebody who litigates informal corporis in federal court owes the money.
That's correct. But in this case...
But you can't say that the service is free.
No.
Because the payment is deferred.
As you indicated, Your Honor, service is provided regardless of whether there is payment. And in Tidwell, this court found that it was profoundly important for that to be explained and for that to be known. Otherwise, the state is in a position of taking money from someone without informing them that they otherwise would have been receiving the services. And in that sort of situation, Tidwell is clear. The involuntarily committed mental patient must be given that information, must be told that their Social Security is otherwise inviolate. The problem here is there's nothing in the protective payee process that provides Ms. Mason and the class with that information. She was never informed.
But since the decision is not made, when there's a representative payee, the decision isn't made by the recipient, it's made by the representative. That's correct.
That's
the underlying problem, at least the problem I keep having.
But the problem, Your Honor, is once the state has this pool of money, whether they be it as a representative payee in this case or requiring the money to be deposited in the hospital as they did in Tidwell, the state is still acting as a creditor. Ms. Mason received back benefits of almost $35,000. The state took $26,000 of this, although by agreement that has been stayed, but the state asserted an interest in $26,000 of this, which covered, my understanding is, all the Social Security she would have received for the time she was at the hospital. The state didn't say, well, should she get some of it? Should some of it go for when she's released? Should it go for her time in the hospital? All of which are considerations the payee is required or allowed to make under the payee statute. The state just says, it's ours. The state acted as a creditor. Faced with the exact same situation, the Supreme Court of Washington in the Kepler case said it's immaterial that the state is the protective payee because the state is not acting as the payee, the state is acting as a creditor. And when a state acts as a creditor, Tidwell is clear, Bennett is clear, Crawford is clear.
But then I think you have to answer my driver's license question differently. I don't understand how your position is consistent with your answer to my driver's license question.
Well, again, Your Honor, I would say that in the driver's license situation, the Tidwell notice is to the person who says, look, you are going to receive these services regardless of whether you pay. They're not free. You will receive a bill, although in Indiana law, the bill goes away after 10 years from your release, you receive a bill. In the driver's license situation, you don't receive a bill and can proceed without payment. You have to pay up front. The state is not asserting...
Your argument depends on the state supplying the service and being a creditor.
That's correct.
That's the case in the driver's license.
I don't think it's the same situation, Your Honor, because the state is compensating itself directly out of a fund which otherwise it would not be able to take and for fees that otherwise would not have to be paid. If Ms. Mason did not have a protective payee, she incurred this bill, the state sent her a letter saying you owe us this money, she could say forget about it. I'm not going to pay.
No, and she can't.
Yes, she can, Your Honor. Because under 407 the state could do nothing to take that Social Security benefit. Anything the state did would amount to legal process. And what the state did here, or attempted to do, again we have a stay in effect for the back benefit, what the state attempted to do and is doing with her current benefits is taking her benefits without her consent, and that is in effect other legal process prohibited by 407. The point is that 407 stands as an impenetrable wall to creditors, and the state here is acting as creditor. She owes the state money, the state is taking her money. It makes no difference if the state is the payee, since at no time has she been given the information required by Tidwell so that she can give her voluntary consent.
Isn't this, Mr. Brock, much in the way you frame this? I mean, you call it a creditor, but what is the state first? Is it, or is there an inherent conflict in the dual role the state has?
I think there's an inherent conflict, and I think that's what the Supreme Court of Washington was referring to in the Kessler case when they said, I believe, that protective payee status at best was immaterial and at worst was conflicting. The problem is that the protective payee status allows the state to act and requires that the state act in the recipient's best interest, first and foremost. And a very good economic argument could be made, again, the court notes this in Kessler, a very good argument could be made that it's not in anyone's best interest to pay a bill that doesn't have to be paid. I understand Judge Easterbrook's point, and of course, this is a bill, it exists, she owes it, but there's no way the state can get to it. And maybe it isn't in her best interest.
Well, is it, would you argue it's not in the best interest because it's contrary to Social Security policy?
No, I would not argue that.
The Social Security policy seems to indicate, if anything, that the safety net aspect of Social Security is honored by Representative Payee handling
that's correct.
Funds.
And it allows the payee in the payee's discretion to use it on current maintenance, but it also allows the payee, as I said, to provide for items to make institutional life better and to prepare for life after the institution. The state of Indiana did not proceed in this way. The state of Indiana proceeded to pay itself back, and that is the sign of a creditor. And as a creditor, taking this money, that violates...
Could it ever pay any part of that those funds and not be a creditor? What if it took as opposed to applying the total sum, 20% each month?
No, I think we have to go back to Tidwell. I don't see any difference between the class here and the class in Tidwell. In both cases, you have people who are being housed in an institution. This institution has this pool of money. Tidwell is quite clear. It could not be taken, not one dime, absent this voluntary consent and this notice.
Did Tidwell precede the Social Security Act allowing for this dual role?
There was in Tidwell there was mention of protective payee, but that status was dealt with in the district court. It was not mentioned in the court of appeal.
Protective payee.
Representative payee. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, we're not.
No, I apologize.
I'm here. Okay.
Representative payee. That was not dealt with. In the Crawford case, It seems like the class in Crawford, the total class, did include representative payees, although it's not clear there was a subclass of people who have representatives, did not have representative payees. The only case that seems to be dealt directly with this, the dual role of state, is the case from the recent case from the Washington
State.
Court.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fall. Mr. Steiner?
May it please the court. In this case, Indiana is doing what Congress and the Social Security Administration expect it to do, yet it's here for this court. None of the cases that have been cited by the plaintiffs in this case in any way suggest that the state cannot act as a representative payee and cannot use funds as prescribed by Social Security law and regulations.
Do you think we have to at least revisit Tidwell's language?
Well, I agree, Your Honor. I don't think Tidwell really decided this case. What happened, in fact, in all these cases, we have a situation in Bennett, in Philpott, the Supreme Court cases, in this court's Tidwell case, in the Ninth Circuit's case in Crawford. We have situations where the state, on its own, either through judicial process or some other means, administrative means, totally on its own, decided to attach Social Security benefits of individuals. And in each of those cases, this court and Tidwell and the other courts had problems with that. None of those cases, and I would submit including Crawford, addressed the situation that we have here, where the state has been named as representative payee, and where that we have this statutory program and we have these regulations that contemplate that the state is going to use some of these funds to pay for maintenance of an individual who's housed in a state institution. So those cases simply just don't control this case. Regarding Crawford, just to make it clear, there is a footnote in Crawford, of course that's that Ninth Circuit case, that is just unclear whether it applies to representative payee situations where the state is representative payee or not. But when you read that decision, the court in no place in that decision suggests that it is talking about representative payees. I think if it was dealing with that issue, and it's an important issue under federal Social Security law, I think they would probably have said something more explicit in their decision. The district court did not read Crawford as addressing this issue, and I don't think any other court that's considered Crawford as having decided issues relating to representative payees.
The money that the plaintiff here would have spent for this person's care and room and board, one thing, that comes from tax money, doesn't it?
That does, Your Honor, sure.
And I've always thought that Social Security, that was really one of the main purposes of Social Security, was to care, take care of people when they're not earning income.
I would agree. I think the regulations set up essentially a program, particularly for people who need representative payees.
Wouldn't it be possible for a person in the situation that they're arguing for just to accumulate those Social Security payments over the whole time they're in an institution, and then they pass away and it goes to their heirs?
It could, yes.
Not to the state.
That could happen, and it would probably
almost
happen.
A windfall.
It would happen in this case if the state is not permitted to use some of those funds as representative payees. Now, I'd like to talk about that just briefly, too. States are appointed as representative payees from time to time because other persons are not available to be representative payees. It's an unfortunate fact that some people are not going to be able to manage their affairs, including their Social Security benefits, in any kind of a reasonable way. And what the laws seem to recognize is that in those cases, you need to have someone assist that person, the representative payee.
You mean a conservator be appointed in the probate court or something of that sort?
Possibly could be. The Social Security Administration has the power and has like a list of people and entities that it can appoint as representative payee. And they look first to family members and things like that, friends who would be capable of protecting someone's interests. But unfortunately, and I think actually Ivy Mason, the named plaintiff in this case, is one of those kind of people. There are some people that don't have someone outside of the institution or outside of an institutional setting that can really serve as their representative payee. And I think there's nothing suggested in Social Security law, and there's nothing suggested in the record in this case, certainly, that suggests that a state mental facility can't properly represent the interests of a person as a representative payee, so long as they follow the guidelines, the federal guidelines. In this particular case, the evidence shows very clearly that the Social Security Administration has offered direction to the Richmond State Hospital regarding Ivy Mason as to how the benefits ought to be used, make sure that money is set aside for Ivy to take care of any special needs that she has first and those kind of things, but that the money, as the Social Security regulations indicate, ought to be used also to pay for her current maintenance. And that's what's been done in her case. Regarding the lump sum amount that Mr. Falk mentioned, there was a amount that the Social Security Administration determined that Ivy was entitled to as back as a result of money she should have received from 1989 to 1997 that she didn't receive. The Social Security Administration felt that that money related to periods of time when she was in the state hospital system and felt that part of that money ought to be applied to that maintenance cost during that period of time. It was the Social Security Administration that suggested how the lump sum should be divided, not the state of Indiana, not Richmond State Hospital. The Social Security Administration suggested that a fair amount of that money should be used for her maintenance and that the remainder should be placed into some sort of CD or some other kind of account that she could use when she got out. But I want to point out again, these amounts were relating to maintenance that related to these past payments that should have been made. And this was a determination that was made by the Social Security Administration, not the state.
Mr. Steiner, let me give you an area of concern of mine, and that is not so much that the state can't wear both hats, but does the individual who makes the determination, for example, within a particular institution, about how to follow the guidelines, is there any wall between that individual, or is that individual in the various institutions, at least separate and apart from the, let's say, the controller of the institution? We have these phenomena in other areas of government, but at least some assurance that the guidelines are followed by somebody not in a direct line of getting out this month's bills.
I think there is some indication of that in the record. There is evidence that there is there's actually a Social Security office on the grounds of Richmond State Hospital. And the evidence is that when a person comes to the facility, the Social Security people, along with treatment people from the facility, talk to the individual, analyze the situation involving the individual, and try to determine what is best in terms of the money and other things relating to the person's
treatment.
The
Social Security people you mentioned who are on the institution grounds, are they federal employees?
They're federal employees, yes. And what's going on here is an effort to determine what is best for the individual. So I think there are some controls involved in the process. In fact, there are advocates for people like Ivy Mason who are in these facilities. And it's my understanding that one of those advocates, that would have been a state employee, assisted Ivy in getting the back Social Security payments, those kind of things, even possibly directed her to Mr. Falk as part of this case. There are people who are involved with mental health patients in states like Indiana.
Is that location of the federal Social Security officer unique to this institution, or can you assume that in other parts of the state this is also occurring?
I think where there's a need, I think there would be an. I don't know whether I frankly do not know whether there are offices on other.
Because I have some unease in relying on whether or not representatives from Washington would fan out across the country, or there's even enough resources in the Social Security system to monitor this. So if Ms. Ivey has a friend that lives in Des Moines, maybe also existing on Social Security, and she'd like her to visit her and send her the bus ticket, I just wonder whether an individual sort of Ms. Ivey, Mr. Steiner, has the ability to extract an $80 sum from the global amount of this month, even though the total amount may not meet what Ms. Ivey needs to honor the debt owed to the state.
I think that they would. As in Ivy Mason's case, it's important to recognize that when the representative payee was appointed.
What concretely happens if the beneficiary doesn't agree with the representative payee's decision?
The beneficiary, or an advocate for the beneficiary assisting them, can approach the Social Security Administration and ask that the representative payee, that is, should be removed. And in fact, that can be done at any time during this whole process. It's obviously not a static process because it's while Ivy Mason is at Richmond State Hospital and she's not.
What is the status of the representative payee under state law? Representative payee, a trustee?
I think the representative payee has some fiduciary responsibilities toward the individual under state law. I don't know that the person, that the representative payee, the person or entity is necessarily a trustee. They do have obligations under federal law to follow guidelines, and if they don't follow guidelines, it can be a federal felony, and they can be removed. And the individual
being removed isn't very useful if you've wasted the proceeds. I mean, suppose our plaintiff very likely can't drive, so my example earlier is a bad one, but suppose the representative payee decides that what she really needs is a Ferrari and spends all of her funds plunks down a Ferrari in the courtyard of this institution.
Well,
I do anything more other than tell him, you know, tut tut, we'll hand over the duties to somebody else?
Well, federal law would make that a felony, that would probably be a felony offense, because that wouldn't be a proper use of the
What statute
benefit.
Is this that you're referring to?
If I recall correctly, I believe it's 408, 42 U.S.C. Section 408, but it's right in the same area, and I could be wrong about the number, but that is the there is a statute, and I don't believe that I have it in my notes up here.
Is it 408?
Yeah, I believe it's 42 U.S.C. 408.
Is there any administrative review of what the representative does, or do we always end up in court like this up here?
The individual who is the beneficiary, the Social Security beneficiary, may object to the appointment of the representative payee. And there is an administrative process and a review process through the Social Security Administration that can be had. And the individual, that's what I was getting to, has the right at any time to object or to raise an issue regarding their representative payee. So
if the issue was raised, what happens to it?
Then there's a review committee
or anything of that sort?
There's a body, there's a hearing held by the Social Security Administration, a determination whether there should be a representative payee. That particular person, their particular entity ought to be a representative payee. They could also decide whether there should be a representative payee at all, again, at any time. That also goes, just so I can briefly touch on it because there's not a lot of time, goes to the due process issue and some of the things that the district court said in this case. What the district court was getting at here, I think, is that there is some due process protection for a person. First, the Social Security Administration is the body that's really making the decision. But even beyond that, there are some protections here in this whole process that the person can avail themselves of. And as the district court said, once the decision is made that a person is not capable of managing their benefits, it doesn't make a lot of sense to go to them and seek their individual consent about specific allocations of resources. So I think in sum, Your Honor, that this is a case where the district court properly recognized that the state was acting as it was intended to act under the Social Security laws and regulations. That to the extent that the Washington State Court case that Mr. Falk referred to decided differently, that was a wrongly decided case. The dissenters in that decision have the best of it, I think. This court ought to recognize that this procedure, this representative payee procedure, permits states properly to act as representative payees as long as they follow the guidelines, and the court ought to affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Falk?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe the record reflects that there was a liaison from the Richmond office in Richmond, Indiana, Social Security office to the hospital. But the decision to apply the money was made by the hospital because the hospital is a creditor. It paid off or it sought to pay off its debt. This was not a Social Security decision. It's a decision by a creditor to pay off a back bill. Even the state here concedes it was a back bill. And that is what a creditor does. A creditor goes after ways of paying off its back bill.
What about the check, though, that the recipient can at any time interrupt that crediting process by just changing the or going through the procedures if they're able to?
Well, the recipient can seek another payee. It's not clear whether the recipient can challenge the allocations of the payee. The case law on that is mixed. And in fact, the Social Security Administration takes a position that once it pays to the payee, its hands are clean. In this case, a payee was appointed for Ms. Mason because, as Mr. Steiner indicated, there really wasn't anyone left. There is a preference in the regulations, and third on the list, I believe, is a state institution. So it's not a viable remedy. In Tidwell, for instance, going back to Tidwell, the remedy was you get consent from the individual. If you get consent, fine. If you don't get consent, you can't take the money. If
well, don't you have implicit consent, at least at the outset of this process?
You have a regulation which allows the payee to use its best interest, which includes perhaps paying this bill. But Ms. Mason was certainly not on notice that all her money was going to be taken, her money would be taken by the hospital, merely because a payee was appointed. In that way, she was no different than the plaintiffs in Tidwell. She knew that she had a sum of money that was going to be residing in the hospital. She did not know it was going to be taken. If she had a guardian, for instance, the guardian would receive the money, and the guardian could refuse justifiably to pay the hospital.
What if it's a public guardian that's funded by the state, Ms. Falk? Would that be acceptable, as opposed to a private attorney, perhaps, that's appointed by the court?
It would not be acceptable in this situation because Ms. Mason is not incompetent under Indiana law. If someone was adjudicated incompetent, Indiana does not have a public guardian per se, but if someone was appointed in that capacity, yes, because that decision would be removed. It really isn't removed now. The hospital is the one making the decision. The hospital is the one incurring the debt, and the hospital is the one paying itself. And that act of payment violates the anti-alienation provision.
Thank you, Mr. Falk. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.